Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The bison, or the buffalo, as it's more popularly known, has loomed large in American history, no pun intended, but it has a troubled history. It's commonly believed that the bison faced near extermination at the end of the 19th century at the hands of Euro-Americans, and that its near demise led to the same close call for an entire race of people, the Native American. We revisit this bit of history this week with Andrew Eisenberg, author of The Destruction of the Bison and Environmental History. And after that, Talking History regular Andrew Schockett returns to provide us with some historical perspective on the recent Massachusetts court decision on same-sex marriages. But first, Dan Roberts completes his series on Civil War women spies in his A Moment in Time.
During the American Civil War, socialite Elizabeth Van Loo ran a Union spy ring in the capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, Virginia.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
Elizabeth Van Loo was a Southern girl born in Richmond in 1818, the daughter of a wealthy family but one with connections and kin in the North. Van Loo was educated in Philadelphia and returned home a convinced and vigorous abolitionist. During the 1850s, she convinced her family to free their slaves, and at the outbreak of hostilities remained loyal to the Union. She committed herself to do whatever she could to support the federal cause. Van Loo occasionally aroused suspicion, so in order to throw off would-be pursuers, she wore dirty clothes and mumbled to herself on the street. Richmonders began calling her Crazy Bet and generally regarded her as harmless. Van Loo, however, was as crazy as a fox and became very adept at getting out vital military and political information. She carried books with notes folded into the spines and food trays with false bottoms to Union soldiers imprisoned in the city. She pried information from unsuspecting Confederate soldiers and officials. During Grant's 1864 siege of Petersburg, Van Loo established relay stations between her home and Union lines. She encoded her messages and sent different parts with different couriers. It is said that one of her operatives, a former slave, Mary Bowser, was a very attentive servant in the White House of the Confederacy, the wartime home of Jefferson Davis. Van Loo exhausted her inheritance financing the spy ring. Under President Grant, she served as Richmond's postmistress, but when she died in 1900, she was penniless and a social outcast. At the University of Richmond, this is Dan Roberts.
Recent developments in Haiti have sent most of us scurrying to our history books to recall the history of this near neighbor about which we know very little. We can't provide a very detailed history in this short segment, but we thought that just hitting the highlights, so to speak, might be helpful. So here you go. Christopher Columbus was the first European to set foot on the island. He visited Haiti in 1492, claiming it for Spain, but it became a French colony in 1697. After over a century of neglect, Haiti won its independence from France in 1804, following a slave rebellion led by Toussaint Louverture, only to be plunged into 2 centuries of political turmoil and economic despair. The country has seen 32 coups ever since, and a long list of failed leaders. The United States occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934. In 1957, François Duvalier was elected president, beginning a 28-year dictatorship that ended in 1986 when his son fled the country. 4 years later, Jean-Bertrand Aristide was elected president, but he was deposed by a military coup in 1991, restored to power in 1994, and deposed once again just weeks ago. Stay tuned. It isn't over yet by any means. This is Talking History. American history, the story of the Native American, and the bison are all linked in some important ways. But like so much of our past, it can be difficult at times to separate history from fiction, or at least to ensure that the entire story is told and not just the one that we choose to tell, for whatever reason. That pretty much frames Fred Nielsen's interview this week with Andrew Eisenberg.
There were once millions of bison roaming America's plains. By the end of the 19th century, they were almost gone. We often think of their near extinction by overhunting as an example of human greed and improvidence. And so it is, but only in part. According to my guest, Andrew Eisenberg, ecological factors, including predatory animals, disease, and drought, are a central part of the story, too. Andrew Eisenberg is a professor of history at Princeton University and the author of The Destruction of the Bison, An Environmental History, 1750 to 1920. Professor Eisenberg, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
In a sense, some of the most significant reductions in the bison population have come as a result of recent scholars' revision of earlier estimates. We've lost tens of millions of bison just in the last few years, it seems. How many were there, in fact, in the 18th and 19th centuries?
The short answer to that question is that there were probably somewhere between 25 and 30 million bison. Scholars had once thought that the bison population was somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 75 million, and this is because they were basing their estimates on the observation of very large summer herds when the animal came together for the breeding season. And they didn't take into account that for most of the year, those populations were spread throughout the plains much more thinly. And as we've got a more sober idea of range carrying capacity and a clearer understanding of the impact of drought and predators, particularly on bison calves, we've pushed those estimates downward.
So the maximum population would be 30 million or so.
30 million or so. That's a good way to put it.
What does the number get down to by the end of the 19th century?
By the end of the 19th century, we have a clearer idea. There were probably fewer than 1,000 bison left by around 1900.
There were no horses in America before the Spanish brought them over in the 16th century, which means that despite our images of Indians on horseback hunting bison, for much of their history, that wasn't the case. They were on foot before they became equestrians. How did they hunt bison in those circumstances?
Before Indians in the Great Plains had the horse, they had some very ingenious techniques for hunting the bison. Essentially, they would encircle the herd on foot, and this meant getting everyone together, not just men, but women and children, and using whatever kinds of brush or other things they could to build a large circle around the herd, and then set fire to the grasses to slowly close this circle around the herd, and then they would pepper the herd with arrows. Another technique was to encircle the herd on three sides and essentially stampede it either over a cliff or into a corral where they would again pepper the animals with arrows.
How does that change when they begin riding, when they become equestrians?
Well, during that summer breeding season, when the bison are conveniently assembled in these large herds, essentially they adapt those older pedestrian techniques to horseback, and they will again encircle the herd. And essentially, they had techniques during the summer where there would be leaders of the hunt, and they would ensure that no single hunter attacked the herd alone. Everyone would have to attack the herd at the same time. And again, they would kind of close a circle and keep the herd confused and pick off the animals that were most valuable to them.
Our main subject here is the destruction of the bison, and by whatever numbers we're using, the astonishing decline in their populations. And yet the Indians themselves become to feel endangered as well, disease, encroachment, and so on. How do they respond to those dangers to themselves?
Well, initially, in the 18th century, when those dangers first emerged for them on the Great Plains, they respond quite well. In fact, I think that you have to think about those Indians of the Great Plains for many decades, for almost a century, being a great success story. They survived in their homeland much longer and much more successfully than a lot of other groups in North America. There was a conquest of the Great Plains. It wasn't a kind of military conquest as it was in other places, but it was essentially an economic and an ecological conquest. There were diseases that moved in. Horses were a new ecological element. There were fur traders who showed up and transformed the economy of the Indians of the Great Plains. And by adapting to the horse, by becoming nomads who specialized in hunting bison for most of the year for their own subsistence and in hunting or trapping beaver for trade with European fur traders, the Indians survived quite well for many decades. But in doing this, they bound their fate to the bison herds. And when the bison began to decline in the middle of the 19th century, the power and the ability to survive of the Plains Indians declined along with it.
You mentioned they're getting caught up in a market system. What impact did that have on them?
Well, it created more hierarchy and some atomization within these Plains societies. It essentially commercialized their economies. They no longer became quite completely oriented around subsistence, but rather around hunting, initially beaver and then later on bison, for commercial purposes and for prestige within their own societies. And this had an impact on the bison population. Beginning really in the 1830s and continuing for a couple more decades, Indian commercial bison hunters put a pretty serious dent into the bison population.
Well, that raises an interesting point. Indians are often romanticized. Their ecological practices contrasted with those of Europeans. And yet, you cite examples of their wastefulness and write at one point that the nomadic Indians were not paragons of conservation.
Right. Well, the Indians did a lot of things that were quite sensible. They had a lot of ethics about sharing resources, about not overhunting. And I think that we can look back at those kinds of beliefs that they had and find them inspirational, and we can try to emulate them where we can. But we shouldn't imagine that any society practices those ethics 100% of the time. And there was a reality about being a bison hunting society in the Great Plains that meant you couldn't always practice those kinds of ethics of good use. There were times when, for instance, when the Indians were on a raiding foray into another group of Indians' territory, they weren't going to make use of every part of the bison that they came across. They were just interested in the meat. Particularly during the summertime when they came together for festive hunts, the Indians often splurged on some wasteful feasts. Now, I don't want to make it seem as if the Indians were just as bad as other kinds of wasteful societies. There are many things about them that were quite sensible and things that we should look at quite closely and try to emulate. On the other hand, we shouldn't make them into ecological saints. We shouldn't make them into a kind of noble savage who existed on a sort of different plane. I think that that's a misrepresentation.
Was the hunting that they did, even when they mounted horses and hunted bison in greater numbers, was that sustainable?
My suspicion is, and this is an educated guess looking at the numbers of the bison, what we think about the numbers of the bison and what we think about their use of the bison, is that before commercial bison hunting in the 1830s, that population of Indians in the Great Plains and their use of the bison was probably right on the edge of sustainability. They were probably hunting just about as many bison as they could afford to. And during years when there were droughts, during years when there were blizzards or grass fires or extra heavy predation by wolves, that they may have actually veered into unsustainability. They were right on the edge. And when they took to hunting commercially in the 1830s, which must have raised their harvest of the bison by 20 or 25%, I think they were clearly into an unsustainable range.
One of your major points is that it isn't just humans, though, who are responsible for the decline of the bison. There were ecological factors, too. Animal predators, which you've mentioned briefly, drought, blizzards, fire, and many other things. I wonder if you could elaborate on the impact those ecological factors had.
Yeah, these are really quite important. I mean, I said at the outset that the maximum bison population was somewhere between 25 and 30 million. But we should think about that as a maximum population and not as a kind of enduring, stable population. The thing to remember about the bison population that's more important than any number that we arrive at is that the bison population was always going up and down. It was fluctuating considerably in response to drought, blizzard, grass fire, predation, competition from other animals, particularly once horses move in and horses are competing with bison for grass and water. So we have to think about that bison population fluctuating considerably. And when a downward fluctuation struck in the middle of the 19th century with persistent droughts throughout the plains, coupled with commercial hunting, first by Indians and later by Euro-Americans, that's what did in the bison population.
We often have a tendency to think that nature is somehow static and unchanging. You drive home the point repeatedly, but that's not the case at all. Nature is dynamic, too.
Yes, and this is, I think, one of the things that environmental history tries to contribute to the larger historical exercise, and that is to think of nature not as a backdrop to history, but as having a historical agency of its own.
Especially after the Civil War, white Americans, Euro-Americans, both soldiers and civilians, hunt the bison in great numbers. How destructive were they? How much did they contribute to the disappearance of, or near disappearance of the population?
They really delivered the death blow, the coup de grace, to the bison population. In terms of absolute numbers, it's hard to calculate. There were probably about 1,000 bison hunters, at least in the southern plains in the early 1870s. They probably were killing about 20 bison a day when they were out in the field. And if you think about them being only in the field for about 3 or 4 months of the year, they could easily have killed about 2 million a year. And when you further take into account the way in which their hunting would have upset patterns of migration and reproduction and foraging and the waste that took place. I mean, they would wound some bison, and those bison would wander away to die without their hides being taken. So hides that are shipped to market are representing perhaps, you know, every hide that's shipped to market is representing one or two or three or more than were actually killed. They really put a serious dent, at least 2 million a year in the early years, and probably more when you add in those ancillary destructions.
Well, your book has some amazing pictures of the piles of bones that have been collected.
Mm-hmm. It's really quite amazing. I'm not quite sure how people reacted to seeing those photos initially. There are lots of photos of settlement and industrial exploitation of the West in the 19th century, and oftentimes those photographs are intended as celebratory. We look at those enormous piles of hides and bones, and our reaction is that it looks quite ghastly. I'm not sure that it was intended that way at the time. I think at the time it was intended as a kind of sign of industrial triumph in the West.
Well, to follow up on that just a little bit, I wondered when Americans finally become aware that the bison population is actually endangered, and when they find out about it, do they care very much?
This is one of the things that really intrigued me about this project when I was working most closely on it. Initially, when I came to the project, I had thought that, as other historians had thought previously, the decline and near extinction of the bison population must have come as a great surprise. And people thought that the bison population was inexhaustible, and they were surprised to find by the 1870s and 1880s that they had nearly exhausted it. As I looked more closely at it, what I found was that as early as the 1830s, there are a number of fur traders and Indian agents in the Great Plains who are reporting quite accurately on the decline of the bison population, and that this is a fact that is well known in policymaking circles in the federal government by the middle of the 19th century. And by the 1870s or so, people in the Interior Department are seeing the decline of the bison population as an opportunity for rounding up these Indians in the plains who are quite difficult to defeat militarily and getting them onto reservations. This does not mean that it was a federal government policy to destroy the bison or that there were federal hunters who were destroying the bison. The hunters who were killing off bison were private entrepreneurs. But it does mean that the federal government commended, even if they didn't command, those hunters.
Well, you quote William Sherman, General Sherman, at one point where he makes that linkage between killing the, or appears to make the linkage, between killing the bison and eliminating Indians as well.
He does, but he didn't have any hunters at his command. Right? He was involved in some treaty negotiations in the late 1860s, and he wrote back to his brother, who was a U.S. senator from Ohio, that it was all right to award to Indians very large hunting territories, as long as there was a stipulation, as there was written into the treaties, that these hunting territories would belong to the Indians so long as the bison were there in numbers as to justify the chase. Because as he wrote back to his brother, the bison just aren't going to be there very much longer.
You conclude your book, when the Euro-Americans capitalized on the nomads, the Indians' ecological Achilles heel, they exposed the fragility of all societies, including their own, that rely on the unsustainable exploitation of nature. What lessons do you draw from your study?
Well, one of the points that I was trying to make in the book, and I think that's inherent in that sentence that you read, is the idea that in some fundamental ways, the story of the Indians is like a lot of human societies, including the Euro-Americans. Rather than distinguishing between these two kinds of societies and making them seem very different, What I tried to do there in the conclusion was draw some similarities. And I think that the rise and fall of those plains nomadic societies is a kind of parable for all sorts of societies that have a singular or an over-reliance on exhaustible resources.
Does that have implications for the present that you'd care to draw?
Oh, I think so. I mean, if you think about the extent to which our society relies on fossil fuels or on other, you know, nuclear energy or other ways to generate electricity, you know, like those plains nomads in the middle of the 19th century who appeared extraordinarily powerful and intimidating to the Euro-Americans who showed up, you know, we have a sense of ourselves as having transcended the limits of nature. We really do rely in fundamental ways on nature. And we should think carefully about whether our use of resources is sustainable.
Well, Professor Eisenberg, thank you so much for visiting with us.
It's my pleasure.
I've been talking with Andrew Eisenberg, the author of The Destruction of the Bison, An Environmental History, 1750 to 1920.
The latest Massachusetts court decision on same-sex marriages may be somewhat unique, but there are some historical parallels to shed some light on how we might view this case. Or at least, that's Andrew Schockett's opinion and our commentary of the week. Schockett is a professor of history at Bowling Green State University.
Last fall, the highest court in Massachusetts paved the way for legal recognition of gay and lesbian unions there, intensifying the national debate on same-sex marriage. If a similar long-ago ruling from the same court is any indication, we'll be in for a bitter debate along a central fault line of democratic government, and it will be decided by courts, not voters. In a landmark 1783 case resembling the one on same-sex marriage, the Massachusetts Supreme Court declared slavery unconstitutional in the Bay State. Commonwealth versus Jennison allowed slaves to sue their masters for freedom. The case addressed the central tension of constitutional democracy, majority rule versus individual rights. Both times, a majority of Americans opposed the court's decisions. Current polls indicate that over half the public opposes same-sex marriage. Likewise, given that in the 1780s only three state legislatures passed abolition measures, it's safe to say that most late 18th century voters were unwilling to give up slavery. Massachusetts courts have thus twice seemingly challenged the will of the majority, the fundamental source of authority in a democracy. Also, both times the court referred to the clause in the Massachusetts Constitution guaranteeing all citizens, quote, inalienable rights, unquote. The presiding judge in the slavery case ruled that slavery contradicted the state constitution's clause declaring, quote, that all men are born free and equal, unquote. Current Massachusetts Supreme Court Judicial Court Chief Justice Margaret H. Marshall cited the same sentence. She reasoned that the state can't deny some pairs of citizens, two men or two women, the same rights it accords to others, a woman and a man. By abolishing slavery and upholding same-sex marriages, the Massachusetts court reaffirmed another dearly held American belief, that everyone's equal before the law. What the slavery issue teaches us about the current debate is that the country's in for a long fight. Slavery supporters clung to their peculiar institution until forced to give it up by Union bayonets, and not until the 1960s did court decisions finally compel all states to eliminate laws that made African Americans second-class citizens. Already, proponents and opponents of same-sex unions are digging in and using the same kinds of contentions employed concerning slavery. Quoting the Bible, invoking the Declaration of Independence and the Federal Constitution, citing the latest research, and making claims about human nature. The battle over same-sex marriage won't result in civil war, but like other emotionally charged issues involving conflicts between individual rights and the popular will, this one will be settled in the courts rather than at the ballot box. So whatever side of the same-sex marriage debate you're on, feel free to get ready to shout your opinions from the rooftop to convince your fellow citizens. But don't hold your breath waiting for them to agree with you.
You've been listening to Andrew Schockett, professor of history at Bowling Green State University. Schockett's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And finally, we leave you with the final installment in our 8-part series of the White House tapes, recordings made in the Oval Office but now offered to the public by the New Press. On October 5, 1986, an aircraft was shot down in Nicaragua, the wreckage of which included two Americans and documents all associated with the CIA and providing evidence that the Reagan administration was secretly supporting Contra rebels in their attempt to overthrow the Nicaraguan Sandinista government. 1 month later, a Beirut, Lebanon newspaper reported that the United States had sold weapons to Iran as part of a deal to free American hostages when Reagan took office. The public outcry led to the creation of the Iran-Contra Review Board, which began on December 1, 1986, with the following remarks by President Reagan.
Well, Senator Tower, Secretary Muskie, General Scowcroft, I am grateful to all of you for agreeing to serve on this board. I know it will take a lot of your time, but your experience and expertise in this inquiry are extremely important in evaluating the National Security Council's staff operations and providing recommendations on how it should operate. The purpose of your undertaking is to review past implementation of administration policies and to conduct a comprehensive study of the future role and procedures of the National Security Council staff in foreign and national security policy. I would like you to focus on that staff, one, develop policy, two, coordinate with other agencies, and three, implement the President's policies, and four, oversee the implementation of these policies by others. I hope that you would take particular care to look into the question of whether and under what circumstances the National Security Council staff was and should be directly involved in the operational aspects of sensitive diplomatic, military, or intelligence missions, such as the Achille Lauro, the TWA hijacking, and Grenada, and Iran. In addition, I have directed the National Security Council staff not to participate in the actual operations associated with such activities, pending the outcome of the report by the Special Review Board. You'll have the full cooperation of all agencies of the executive branch and the White House staff in carrying out your assignment. And I want to assure you and the American people that I want all the facts to come out. Upon learning of a possible transfer of funds from the sale of arms to Iran to those fighting the Sandinista government, we acted to learn the facts. And we'll continue to share the actions we take and the information we obtain with the American people and the Congress.
You've been listening to President Ronald Reagan addressing members of the Special Iran-Contra Review Board on December 1, 1986. Permission to play the recording was given by the New Press, which has published a collection of White House tapes and a companion book under the same title. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OEH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. The Organization of American Historians and Talking History wish to recognize and thank Neil Baker and the Liberty Legacy Foundation for their generous support. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.